Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? Even the thought of it's so absurd. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without books?
Where would we be?
Where would we be without Gutenberg?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm talking to Steve Erickson, one of our nation's terrific writers, who's written his, I think, ninth novel, These Dreams of You. It's published as a paperback original by Europa, and it takes the stakes of novel writing about as far as I think they can go, because it subjects everything, life, home, career, spouse, children, to possible loss. It's going to take a character whose name is Zan and take everything step by step away from him, leaving him with the things that we're left with when everything else is gone. Certain dreams, certain songs, things that are stuck in his head, refrains, bits of music, and track him there. Now, what is it about you that makes you make your character surrender so much in the course of a book?
I mean, I think all work has a personal quality about it. Even the most imagined work is informed by some kind of personal experience. And it may be that in this particular book, that fourth wall, if you will, comes down faster and louder and more resoundingly than any of the other novels. It finds a moment that is kind of a hinge in the lives of these particular characters, which include a family that's adopted a small girl from Africa, and it also takes place at a kind of temporal hinge in the life of the country. It's a story that's going on right now, or at least in the most recent past, and in a way, it's a kind of historical novel, except it's a history that's going on. But what was important to me was that history always be personal, and that it always and that it be shot through with the personal experience that the character is going through. And this is a character who, exactly as you say, is at a kind of precipice. He's trying to climb his way out.
Wow. So he's already atop things and he's climbing out. In other words, he's getting into a narrower and narrower strait as he goes along. And the book takes him away from every comfort zone. That is to say, he finds himself at moments remembering the time when he fled his wife and went to Berlin, mm-hmm. the time when his wife had an affair with another man, a man who's now offering to pay him to give a lecture.
Right.
The house, rats are turning up in it all the time. The bank is foreclosing on the house. The little girl, two when she's adopted, four now, is the only one in the family who does not support Barack Obama. and it's trying to explain the impossible questions to that little girl. Why do you have lighter skin than mine?
Right.
Who am I?
Right.
Where does the fact that I don't come from mommy's tummy where do I come from? What does that mean?
Right.
And they have another child, and that other child, sibling rivalry is rife. They both accuse both parents of loving the other child. You love him, her, more than me.
Right. Because of the circumstances of their lives, it behooved me, I thought, in writing the story to try and find ways to occasionally be funny about it, even if the humor has a certain dark streak, and kind of like the characters themselves, to find some value in not only lives that are defined by these harrowing circumstances, but in a country that is trying to live up to the mythic implications of this election and finds that it can't. So that when this family winds up in a kind of exile, strewn out across Europe and Africa, and they're watching the spectacle of the country sort of unravel from 3,000 miles away, it's a perspective that both alienates them, but that also pulls them back home in the end.
Now, the election of Barack Obama and the presence of this black child make the hero invoke a figure rather like Robert Kennedy, who seems in the book to stand for the last time America stood on the brink of its amazing and shocking and improbable promise. What does Robert Kennedy mean to you?
Well, there's a crucial moment in the story where the father of this family, Zan, is thrown back 40 years in time and remembers an event at a campaign rally where the crowd is gripped in such a delirium that a kind of hysteria takes hold, and he thinks he's about to be trampled, and this young black woman rescues him and pulls him from the crowd, and their lives will go on to intersect in ways that they never know in the course of the book. The Kennedy comparison was natural to me because I remember it. I'm dating myself, but I do. And there were things about the Obama campaign that reminded me of the Kennedy campaign. The idealism and the fervor and the intensity and the sense of investment. There are ways actually in which Obama himself reminds me more of John Kennedy. But the campaign that he waged was much more like Robert's in the sense that it felt like the kinds of things you were talking about were at stake, and that this was a moment when the country could realize a better vision of itself. And there's the implication in this story that the Obama campaign sort of picks up from where that last campaign, which was ended by an assassin's bullet, so abruptly fell off 40 years before.
Ended by an assassin's bullet in Los Angeles. What is it? You know, you're a Los Angeles writer.
Right.
You live here. What is it about the city that creates the sense, do you think, of ultimacy, of, you know, the end of promise?
Well, it is geographically at the far end of the New World. It is historically at the far end. It is enough of a blank slate of a city that people feel the invitation to come and write on that slate. Sirhan Sirhan, Robert Kennedy's assassin, had been living in Pasadena for years after coming from Palestine. And kind of like the country itself, and in a way that makes Los Angeles as much the ultimate American city as any other, it's a city of possibility, and it's a city of foreboding and doom, and the very juxtaposition, for instance, of the fact that the Kennedy assassination took place at the Ambassador Hotel, where they used to have the Academy Awards. That kind of collision of a reality, of stark reality, harrowing reality, and pure fantasy, comes naturally to Los Angeles in a way that I think informs both of those things. That changes the reality, and also has an impact on our dreams.
It's Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Steve Erickson about his book, These Dreams of You, which follows an incredible arc of loss and destruction before a family can return home to Los Angeles, as if in order to move forward, they've got to go all the way to their bottom.
That's right.
It's kind of an amazing book for anyone who knows Steve, because you have adopted an Ethiopian daughter.
Right.
And, you know, a trip to England was a part of your itinerary
right.
a few years ago.
Right.
And so it feels like a horrific fantasy in the form of autobiography mm-hmm. or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
What makes you try that? That's an amazing kind of feat.
I think, you know, at this point it sort of comes naturally. I think that, you know, imagination and experience are always conspiring in the writing of fiction. I think that things that seem purely imagined are always have more basis in experience than the reader and maybe even the writer knows. I think things that are based in experience wind up being transformed by the imagination. There are things about the story that don't neatly coincide with my own biography. And I think that that becomes important. I think at some point in the writing of this book, you know, probably about the time that Zan and his son are on a train under the English Channel, these characters actually stopped looking exactly like the people that they were modeled on. They began to resemble more, you know, second or third cousins, because the novel takes on a life of its own. The characters take on lives of their own. They declare their independence from the models on which they're based. And that, you know, that stew of imagination and experience is where fiction comes out of.
Yeah, it strikes me that there's a part of what you do that comes out of personal essay
mm-hmm.
that, to some extent, if Tolstoy's novels were said by Henry James to be loose, baggy monsters, that a novel by Steve Erickson is a place where a lot of forms can come. Essays about America, about nighttime, about dread, essayettes, really. Mm-hmm. About visionary feelings, and the job is always, can these bones live? Mm-hmm. Will they cohere into the form of a novel? It's necessary in your books
right.
that there be an act of transformative imagination so that all of these elements, the things that are residing in your mind, have to combine into the suspense and plot-driven thing that we think of as a novel.
Right. And, particularly in the case of this novel, as you know, there's a lot of different elements. And it has a kind of kaleidoscopic quality, I think. And, you know, the one of the things that I was very intent on was creating a vortex, if you will, that would pull the reader through these things. That is, every time that the book stops to ruminate about something for a couple of paragraphs, that rumination has some impact on the larger story of this family going on. So it became important to me that all these little, as you call them, essayettes or ruminations or memories or riffs fell under the umbrella of this story. That the story of the family is not just there to support a lot of different other things going on. Those other things are there to support the story of the family.
There are these iconic figures like Robert Kennedy who provoke new stories.
Right.
Kennedy actually appears with a woman who might be related to the black adopted child. Robert Kennedy seems to be having an affair with her. David Bowie, as well, hires her as a manager, a figure like David Bowie,
right.
A redheaded, ambisexual extraterrestrial.
Right.
And just as Kennedy speaks of political possibility at the edge, he speaks more or less as a poet and to the black community.
Mm-hmm.
Bowie appears to speak to the gender, the mix of genders,
right.
As a kind of poetry, as a source for his songwriting art.
Mm-hmm.
Both of these figures are presented as being tremendously frail, shaking,
mm-hmm.
thin, as if to live at these points of possibility means that your physical balance is overthrown. Of course, yes, these people were very skinny, yes, but it's as if they're being eaten away by the danger of being at certain hinge points or fringe points.
Yeah, I think they're keenly aware of being fragile. And, you know, as you alluded to before, there's a moment for Zan about three quarters of the way through the book where he not only wonders if he lost everything, he wonders if he ever had it. And he is at his most fragile. And that's a moment he has to come back from and assure himself that the life he thought he was living was his.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Steve Erickson about his new book, These Dreams of You. We'll continue after this short break.
This is Connie Alvarez. Bookworm is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station in Los Angeles. It costs money to put this program together. Please help support us by going to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Steve Erickson about These Dreams of You, a present-day novel set in Los Angeles that takes us on the quest for identity and family and more. These figures seem to represent zeitgeist figures. Obama, Kennedy, Bowie. And as such, they seem to be figures that the music in the book is compelled to write songs about.
Mm-hmm.
The songs in the air are the songs about zeitgeist figures.
Right.
And that this seems to be what art is too, that our songs are about our culture and our novels are too.
Yeah, I think the music is in the air, as you say, and the, You know, we, or I'll speak for myself, I came out of a time where the zeitgeist was saturated with music. It wasn't just the soundtrack for the zeitgeist. The zeitgeist and the music were almost interchangeable. The zeitgeist was defined by the music. And Zan comes out of that time as well. And he sees in this fragile moment, again, where the country has done something that would have been unfathomable just a few years ago in its election of a black Hawaiian with a Swahili name, which sounds like science fiction. In this fragile moment, Zan sees the zeitgeist kind of teetering between what it can become and what it could fall back into, and it brings up for him I think a lot of memories, and virtually every memory, as he notes at one point, has got some kind of a melody about it.
It's kind of amazing because the book, moves from burning down the house to losing the house, and that we've got a country that has got to invent. It's in a crisis of faith. And Zan, confronted, says ultimately that he believes in God, that it doesn't make sense otherwise, and that whatever belief system you are in, you're the enemy of another one.
Mm-hmm.
That you are always defining yourself as moving toward something by the act of moving away from something else. Can you describe that? It was such a moving and extraordinary passage.
Well, Zan, says he believes in God 51 days out of 100. And, at the same time, he has become, over the course of his life, skeptical of belief systems. He's become skeptical of political ideology. He's become skeptical of religious ideology. There's one point where he talks about essentially the creation of Christianity as a literary act. I think that's what leaves Zan feeling so fragile, is because, he has certain convictions, but exactly as you alluded to, none of his belief systems really support it. Support those convictions. Those convictions are beliefs he's had to arrive at on his own, and he's had to arrive at them as somebody who has become disenchanted with all the systems that might support them. So it's a different kind of faith, and it's a more precarious kind of faith, even as it probably is the only kind that he can have.
There are points in the book where the author is compelled to write what I think of as the equivalent of a political poem, a version of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream, or of some of Robert Kennedy's more dangerous and visionary speeches, that there's a point in your writing where climaxes coincide with the occasion for the oracular to give a remarkable speech poem that many people would say is not the business of novel writing. It goes completely to a different frame of transcendence. Tell me how.
I think I'm at the point where I don't worry too much about what's the business of novel writing. It's if it works on the page for me, then it's then it justifies itself. I can give you one example that's a little bit related, talking about the power of speech and the power of expression, which is something that I think the novel talks about a lot. Sheba, the 4-year-old, is a very precocious child. She says things that are difficult for a 4-year-old that are difficult to believe a 4-year-old would say. When I delivered this novel, my editor's only criticism was that a 4-year-old would in fact say such things, and there were certain things he highlighted, and because the last refuge of a bad writer is to explain that, well, it's okay because it happened in real life, I actually had to tone down Sheba. I took out some of the precocious things that I know for a fact a 4-year-old can and would say, because while my own daughter can be unbelievable, my character can't. This becomes a novel about people expressing themselves beyond what they've ever allowed themselves to express, and about a country that has expressed itself beyond what it ever has allowed itself to express.
That's great. I've been talking with Steve Erickson, author most recently of These Dreams of You, published by Europa Editions in a paperback fiction original. Thank you, Steve, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael, very much.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from These Dreams of You at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.